Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Chaf Hei Amud Aleph with the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, "Marchikim et hanevelot, et hakivarot, et haburski min ha'ir chamishim amah." One has to distance this type of work, which involves malodorous items, things that smell terrible, and therefore we don't want them near the city because it would affect the residents of the city, would make it unpleasant for them to live there. So we require a minimum of chamishim amah, 50 amot distance between these items and the city itself. This is a distance that we've already seen a number of times in the Mishnayot, which means that it's sufficiently far away that it won't impact on the residents of the city. So that is true if one is working with nevelot, carcasses, farot, with the burial of the metim, or burski is a place where they tan the hides, where they work the hides and has a terrible odor to it. For that reason, you have to distance these items from the city so it doesn't affect the residents of the city. Then the Mishnah continues and says, "Ein osim burski ela mizrach ha'ir." You're only allowed to make an area where they work the hides, the tanning area, on the eastern side of the city. Now, it's not clear here from the Mishnah whether burski here is being used as a representative item for the items that were mentioned before in the Mishnah, or whether this is unique to burski because it has something that is extreme in its smell, and it's so malodorous that we want it only to be on the eastern side of the city. The reason for that, Rashi says over here, "She'ein ruach mizrachit kashet ha'dir tamid, elim kein ba lepuranut." Because the eastern wind, eastern min winds, comes from the eastern side, is very gentle, and it only comes once in a while when it's coming to punish, it comes in a strong force. But because the wind is a mild wind, if you put it on the eastern side of the city, the wind itself won't carry the smell so far, and therefore it won't affect the residents of the city. On the other hand, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it, and Tosafot says something similar, is Mipnei Shiruach Maravi, Shehita Dira, Smenashevet, since the westerly winds, those that come from the western side, are blowing constantly, V'duche HaSrecha She'en HaBaleir, and therefore it pushes the smell away from the city. So Rashi claims that the eastern side is beneficial because the winds humming from the east are much gentler, and therefore they won't bring it closer to the city, or they won't bring it as strongly towards the city, whereas the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Balei HaTosafot indicate that we put it on the eastern side because the western winds are much more continuous or persistent, and therefore they will blow the smell away from the city on a regular basis. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Chol ruach hu oseh chutz mimarava, that you're allowed to put this on any side of the city with the exception of the western side, umarchik chamishim amah, and you have to leave at least a distance of 50 amot. This is, again, a dangling modifier. It's not clear whether the marchikim chamishim amah, that you distance it 50 amot, applies to the first statement of Rabbi Akiva, which is that you can put the burski on any side with the exception of the western side. So therefore, the sides that you do put it on, you have to put it at least 50 amot away. Or whether the chamishim amah is modifying the marava, the western side. And on the other side, you could bring it closer. On the western side, you must put it a minimum of 50 amot away. The Gemara will ask that question because it's unclear from the Mishnah. Umarchikim et ha-mishra min ha-yerek. This will be familiar to us. We saw this back on Daf Yud Chet, which is that one has to take the flax soaker, at least keep a distance between it and vegetation or vegetables that are planted nearby. Et ha-krishin min ha-betzalim. And leeks, you must keep them away from the onions. Et ha-chardal min ha-divorim. And the mustard seed from the bees. In each of these instances, the item is detrimental to the other item. The flax soaking affects the yerek, the vegetation that grows nearby. The leeks take away from the sharpness of the onions if they're planted too close by. And we spent a lot of time on the chardal min ha-dvorim, which, as Rashi noted before, that the pungency of the mustard seed causes the bees either to produce less honey or to eat their own honey, and therefore they affect the bees. Rabbi Yossi matir b'chardal. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi, in this last instance, says that it's fine by the chardal. We'll see the bright that's quoted at the end of the Gemara before the next Mishnah. But we already dealt with this in detail back on Daf Yud Chet as to what is Rabbi Yossi's position. But basically, his position revolves around the fact that there is bidirectional damage being done here, that both the mustard affect the bees, but the bees also affect the mustard. Ibailu. So the Gemara asks the question that we raised. Rabbi Akiva, hachikamah. What is the meaning of Rabbi Akiva's statement? He can put the burski, he can put the hide workings, the tanning areas on any side of the city, and he can put them proximate to the city. Chutz mimarava, with the exception of the western side, the marchik nunama. There he has to distance it a minimum of 50 amot. Veoseh, but you can still do it on the western side. You just have to be a minimum of 50 amot away. Odil malucho ruach veoseh. Or maybe you can do it on any side. Umarchik chas mishimama. And you have to distance it. If you do it on any side, you have to put it a minimum of 50 amot away. Chutz mimarava, denoseh klal. The exception on the western side, which you can't do it at all. Tashma. So we have a bright that clarifies this position of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva omer lechol ruach huoseh, humarchik chamishim amah. He can put it on any side, but he has to put it at least a minimum of 50 amot away. Chutz mimarava, den huoseh kol ikar. The exception of the western side where he can't put it all. Bipnei shehi tidira. Because it is consistent or persistent, the Gemara will then ask, what does that mean, tadira? But what we see from the Braita is very clear that in the Mishnah, when it says, Umarchikim chamishim amah, according to Rabbi Akiva, that's modifying the other directions besides the west. So you can put the Bursky on any side of the city with the exception of the western side. And when you put it on any side besides the western side, you must distance it from the city a minimum of 50 amot. Amalei Rova Rav Nachman, my tadira. What is meant by the word tadira, persistent or consistent, that Rabbi Akiva uses to describe the Ma'arav? Ilema tadira biruchot, if you say that it is the most persistent in terms of the wind, v'hama Rav Chanan bar Avamarav, dalet minuchot minashvot b'chol yom. There are four winds that blow every day, biruach tzfonit im kulan, and the northerly wind is mixed in with all of them, shil malei kein in olam mitkayim afilu sha'achat. Because if it were not for that mix of the northern wind, which is a gentle, mild wind that calms the other winds down, then the world would be destroyed. And the other winds are too strong or too powerful. And the northerly wind has a mitigating factor. But if you say that, then the northern wind is the one that is always there or persistent or consistently there and not the western side. Beruach dromit kashem mikulan. And the southern side is the worst of all, or the most powerful of the winds, and can do the most damage. V'ilmalei ben neitz shema'amida, if it were not for the fact that the shade ben neitz, or the malach, named neitz, stops that wind, mecharevet ato olam, it would destroy the world. Shenemar, because it says, ha'mebinatcha ya'aver neitz, is it through your wisdom that the hawk hovers above by the wind? Fros kinafav the teiman, that he outstretches his wings to the south. So the way that the Gemara is reading this, it's reading it in a more allegorical manner, which is, through your wisdom, do you have Nates, who is this Malach, who stretches out his wings to block the winds from the south and protects the land of Israel from being destroyed by these southerly winds, rather than the little way that I translated the Pasuk. So now, based on that, Elamata Dira, what does it mean that it's consistent or persistent? Tadira bishchina. It's where the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. And so the way Rashi learns it over here, now the word tadira, instead of being persistent or consistent, comes from the word dira, that's shochenet. That is where the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is manifest. Based on this, Rabbi Akiva restricts using the western side because that's the place or the location where the shechina is found. And therefore it would be inappropriate to put something malodorous like a burski on the western side. And it has nothing to do with the winds themselves, but has to do with the holiness or uniqueness of the western side. Now, the Gemara here is going to launch into discussing the winds and different impacts of the winds. Just a little background, since in Eretz Yisrael, what the Gemara is describing here is the fact that when winds come from the south, they come from the desert, the Negev, and they bring with them very hot air, or a shrav, a heat wave, which is destructive and difficult. And so therefore, when the wind comes from the south, it's considered to be a destructive or difficult wind that comes. And what the Gemara is saying here is, were it not for the fact that you have this malach that stands in the way and stops the wind, if the wind continued to blow continuously, or after it starts, it did not stop, then it would destroy the land. It would dry everything out. So that's the allegorical statement that the Gemara is saying from the Pasuk, that the southerly wind, which brings this type of heat wave and destructive dry forces with it, is limited. It doesn't continuously blow, but only happens on an occasion and brings with it that type of weather. but it's not a weather that stays, it's a weather that breaks, because the way the Gemara is reading it allegorically, there are the wings of the Malach that block it, or because other winds come in and mix with it and move it away. Now, we also saw in the Mishnah the idea that the westerly wind blows on a continuous basis, and that's the way the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Baal HaTosafot support explained why you can put it on the eastern side of the city, is because the western wind is continuous. And again, if you live in Eretz Yisrael, the western wind is the most common wind to come. It comes off the ocean into Eretz Yisrael. And if you notice, around sunset every day, the wind picks up in Eretz Yisrael. Right around sunset, about half an hour beforehand, the wind suddenly picks up, even on the hottest days, and it comes from the western side. Chazal and the Rishonim in other contexts speak about this, and we'll see a little bit of it later in today's daf. That is because when the sun sets on the western side, they thought that it penetrated through the rakia, the firmament, and the kippah, this enclosure of the world which the sun went through. And as it penetrated through that chalon, it caused friction or other types of stirring, which causes the wind to blow. And that's why they thought that the wind started to blow from the western side as the sun set. But again, here we have this idea that the western wind is a wind that is a little more persistent, or it happens more often in Eretz Yisrael. And now the Gemara continues, Damar Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi, Bo menachzik tova lavoteinu. Let us give credit to our forefathers. Rashi over here says, Avoteinu anshei Knesset HaGdola, because they who wrote Sefer Ezra gave us this pasuk, Shehudia makom tfila. They told us which way we should daven. Dichtiv, because the pasuk says, Utzva shemaim lechamish tachavim, that the constellations of the sky bow down to you, and the assumption being that the sun that rises in the east and the moon that is there, it's not always there, but the sun being the primary constellation, comes from the east, and the way that you come towards someone who's important is by walking in and bowing down, and so it must be the sun that's coming from the east is bowing to the west, where the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. And through that pasuk, we know that the Shekhinah is found on the western side. Matki flora vacha by Yaakov, Bedilma ke'evich notel pras mirabo, b'chozer la'achora v'mishtachave. How do you know that that's the proper explanation of the pasuk? Maybe it's someone who is taking leave of his master, taking leave of the king. The way that you do it is you take something from the king, and then you walk backwards away from the king, bow down. So maybe that's what the son is doing. Maybe the son is taking leave of the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore moving to the west in a bowed manner, where he's taking leave of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which means the Shekhinah would be on the eastern side. Kasha, that leaves an unresolved issue. You're right, you could explain the pasuk that way, and therefore this is not a proof. Rabbi Hoshaya Savar, another Rabbi Hoshaya believes, Shekhinah b'chol makom. Shekhinah is found in all locations, or in all directions. As the Baal HaTosafot point out over here, this Gemara is at odds with the Gemara in Brachot. The Gemara in Brachot speaks about the fact that we daven towards Yerushalayim, based on the pasuk in Melachim Aleph, where Shlomo HaMelech says that all tefillot will come towards this location, the place in the Mikdash. And based on that, we daven, no matter where we are, towards Yerushalayim, and in Yerushalayim, towards the Mikdash. But over here, seemingly the Gemara has positions that are at odds with that, that say that we daven either here to the western side, or the possibility that was raised that maybe to daven towards the eastern side, or about Shaya, seems to me that we're indifferent. We daven to any direction, because the Shekhinah is found everywhere, that these positions are all in contradiction with the position in the Gemara in Brachot. And all of these Amoraim, Tosfot says, don't hold of this memra in the Gemara in Brachot, Shechayim Adam Litpalel Neged Yerushalayim. But they all hold like the Amoraim over here, which is that the Shekhinah is found in all directions, or in particular directions here. Now the Baal HaTosafot then asks, why don't these Amoraim learn from the Mikdash? The Mikdash itself is set up in such a manner that the Kodesh HaKodeshim is on the western end of the Mikdash, and in the Mikdash itself, the whole Mikdash faces towards the west, which would be indicative of the fact that the Shekhinah is found on the western side, or should give you some indication as to which direction you would want to dominate. So he says that you can't use the Mikdash as a paradigm. Yisham ein lumo, da'afagav d'shkina b'chol makom, yivshar adasim aron v'kaporet el v'tzad echad. He says it's a practical problem. Even if you believe that the Shekhinah is in all directions, you have to put the Aron in one place. You have to set up the Mikdash in a particular direction. So no matter which direction you pick, you would always have that question. And so he says it's a matter of practicality and not a matter of that the Shekhinah is found on the western side. Veritz Baomer, and he brings an alternative answer, which is that the Shekhinah Barav, that you can't learn something from that, because even though the Beit Kodshei HaKodashim was situated on the western side of the Mikdash, the Aron, which is the representative of the Shekhinah, was not on the western side of the Kodesh HaKodashim, but rather either centered or maybe pulled toward the eastern side of the Beit Kodesh HaKodashim. And therefore, it doesn't give you an indication as to where the placement of the Shekhinah is. On the other hand, the Yad Ramah disagrees, the Balei Tosafot, and says that these sugyot have nothing to do with each other. That the fact that the Shekhinah is Bechol Makom doesn't necessarily mean that you can daven in every direction. Rather, this is a philosophical, theological statement about the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And as we'll see later, it might be coming to oppose other views as to where God was found or the direction in which God was found, as opposed to the Gemara in Brachot, which is speaking about Tefillah and the direction of Tefillah towards the Mikdash. So then in that way, you could separate the two sugyot and say that they're not dealing with the same issue, and therefore there's no stira over here. So now the Gemara continues with Rabbi Shaya, Om Savar Shekhinah B'chol Makom. Shaya believes that the Shekhinah is found in all locations. Damar Rabbi Shaya, Mai Dichtiv. What is meant by the pasuk? Atahu Hashem levadecha, ata sita te shamayim. That you Hashem are alone. You created the heavens. Shluchachecha lo kishluchei basar v'dam. Your messengers, your emissaries, are not like those of mortals. Shluchei basar v'dam, the shluchim, messengers of those mortal men. Mimakom shemishtachim l'sham machzirim shlichutan. The only way for them to indicate that they've completed the mission that they were sent on is to return to the sender. So when the person sends them out, they go to do the mission or accomplish whatever they were asked to do. And the only way that the person who sent them is informed of that fact is when they return and tell them that that's the case. On the other hand, when it comes to Hashem, your emissaries, your shlichim, wherever you send them, that's where they give over the information or identify the fact that they have completed their mission. Shenemar, because it says, Hatishalach berakim veleilechu, veyomru lecha hinenu, that you send the bolts of lightning and they go, veyomru lach, and they say to you, hinenu, we're here. The Rabbi Yoshaya is medayik, yavou veyomru lenemar, doesn't say that they come and inform HaKadosh Baruch Hu of this, ele veyelechu veyomru, they go, and they inform HaKadosh Baruch Hu, L'meit sheshchinah b'chol makom. Shows you that no matter which direction the lightning goes in, wherever it goes, that's where it informs HaKadosh Baruch Hu that it's accomplished the mission that it was sent on, and you don't need to return in order to inform HaKadosh Baruch Hu that the mission was accomplished. And that's indicative of the fact that the Shekhinah is found b'chol makom. V'af Rabbi Shmuel savar shekhinah b'chol makom. And then Rabbi Shmuel has the same view as Rabbi Yeshaya, that the Shekhinah is found everywhere. The Tana debate Rabbi Shmuel. Minayim sheshchinah b'chol makom. How do we know that the Shekhinah is present or manifest in all directions? Shenemar, because the pasuk says, Vihinei hamalach hadover bi yotzei. The malach that was speaking to me left. Umalach acher yotzei likrato. And then another malach was approaching to greet him. Acharav lo nemar. Doesn't say after him. Ela likrato. To greet him. That shows you that the Shekhinah is in every place. So here, there's the story in Zechariah, when he's measuring Yerushalayim, and he's getting messages through Malachim from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the first Malach who approached him leaves after giving him information or instructions, and then there's a follow-up, another Malach comes. But the second Malach that comes does not come from the same direction that the first Malach came from. It doesn't say that he followed up, or he came after the first Malach. Rather, it says it comes to greet. He's coming from the opposite direction of where the first malach came from. Now, if the malachim are shlichim, are messengers or emissaries of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they're coming from wherever Hashem is present. So if Hashem was in a single location, you would expect all the malachim to come from that single location. Instead, you're seeing a malach come once from this side, and then the other time he's coming from the opposite side, which implies that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is found in all directions, or the Shekhinah is b'chol makom. V'af Rav Sheshet Tzavar Shekhinah b'chol makom. Rav Sheshet is also of this thinking that the Shekhinah is found everywhere. Rav Sheshet says to his Shamash, the one that helps him out, the Chol Ruchato, Ukman, you can't set me up to daven facing any direction, the Varmi Mizrach, with the exception of the eastern side. Not because the eastern side doesn't also have the Shekhinah present there. But rather because the minim are focused on that location. The way Rashi writes it is, Tamidei Avodah Zarah, those that worship Avodah Zarah, Morim Hora'ah Litpalel B'Mizrach, they instruct you to daven towards the eastern side. Seems from here that Rashi is leaning towards his explanation of Christianity, where they daven or they pray towards the eastern side. Rabbeinu Gershom says something which Rashi could be referring to as well, which is that Shemishtachavim Litzva Shamayim, that they bow to the sun. These are sun worshippers that go to bow to the constellations, Yotzi Min HaMizrach, that come out of the eastern side. So either it's those Ovdei Avodah Zarah, those worshippers of the sun that bow down to the eastern side, or other religions that bow down to the eastern side. And the truth is, there might be a correlation between them, the influence of paganism on these religions to face or to daven towards the eastern side. And so Rav Sheshet's objection davening to the eastern side was only because he didn't want to emulate or seem that he was endorsing that type of behavior by these other religions, and therefore he avoided davening to the eastern side. Absent that, he would have been happy to daven to that side and any side. So this is a little more supportive of what Tosafot says, that this Gemara is at odds with the Gemara in Brachot, because over here it's really speaking about davening and not simply about some philosophical or theological view of where the Shekhinah is present, because here Rav Sheshet is speaking about davening. Although you could argue that Rav Sheshet's point about davening in any direction besides the Mizrach was coming to upend that view that the Mizrach or the eastern side was more important, not that in particular he was going to daven to any side and not to Yerushalayim. He's just making a point that it's fair game to daven to any side because what they're saying about the east is just untrue. So now we had three Amoraim who all said that the Shekhinah is found b'chol makom. And now we have a differing opinion, which is Rabbi Abba Amar Shekhinah b'marav. The Shekhinah is found on the western side. Dami Rabbi Abba, my Oriya. What is meant by the word Oriya? This is obviously a foreign language. In the foreign language, Oriya is describing either Rashi brings Kach Korin the Marav b'lashon Parsi. In Persian, that is the name for the western direction. It's called Oriya. And the Balei HaTosafot bring that both the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rach think that Rashi's explanation that speaking about the west is correct. And you can see the Rabbeinu Gershom also explains that Korim b'lishonam l'ruach maravi, that's the western side. And therefore, what it means is avirka, that is the space or the location of God. Oriya is a contraction of the words avirka, the location of God, and that's why the western side is called Oriya. On the other hand, Rashi brings an alternative explanation, which is v'lenira shekach korim l'mizrach v'lashon las. He says that in a foreign language, Oriya is actually the eastern side. And that's what it means here. Avir Ka means the space in front of God. God who is present in the western side, the Avir Ka, the space in front of God, is found on the eastern side. And that's the way Rashi explains it. I'm Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda says, "My dichtiv, what is meant by the pasuk in Shira Tazinu? Yarof kamatar lichi, my teachings should drip like the rain. Zo ruach maravit." That's speaking about the western wind, shiba'a mi'orfo shel olam, which comes from the back of the world, or oref is the back of the neck, but the back of the world. So now you have to explain, what does that mean, mi'orfo shel olam? Rashi quotes, and this is what's found in the Rabbeinu Gershom as well, which is, anisha mati mi'chazko shel olam. Mi'orfo shel olam means is when you came from the strong location, or the great location of the world, Shashchina b'marav, because that's where God is present. So therefore, arfo shel olam, the oref, is coming from the place that is solid and strong, which is the place where God is found. And that's why the western side is called the oref. On the hand, Rashi offers an alternative, which is that in the Torah, we find in numerous instances that the ma'arav is called achor. It's called the back or the end. And we know that from the psukim in the Torah, which gives a name to the east of Kedem, Kedima, which means the front, and it calls western side Achor, because we know it's called the Yam HaAcharon. The Mediterranean Sea is known as the Yam HaAcharon, and we have other places, Kedem VeAchor, that refer to east and west. In addition to that, we also find that Yamin and Smol in the Torah mean south and north. And that is, for instance, by Avram Avinu, when he's chasing after the kings, it says that he goes mismol to Damesek. He goes left of Damesek. Over there, the smol is not to the left or to the west of Damesek. It means, if you look in the Targum there, north of Damascus. And similarly, when Abram proposes to Lot to split up Eretz Yisrael, he says that if I go to the right, you'll go to the left. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. He was not referring to east and west, which is similarly what happens because Lot goes to the eastern side there. It says there that he goes, Mekedem. And same thing with Adam HaRishon when he's thrown out of Gan Eden. And Cain, when they're all sent away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they go Kedem. They go eastward. So therefore, we see again the word Kedem uses east. But the small and Yamin that Avram referred to by Lot was north and south. Again, you can see that Rashi brings it in the Targum over there. Notes it that that's talking about north and south. That is because the HaKadosh Baruch Hu faces towards the east. So if Hashem is found on the western side and faces, if you face eastward, then Kedem, the Panim, or the face of the world, is in the east. Achor and the Oref would be on the western side. And then Yamin, if you're facing towards the east, then Yamin is south. And Smol is north. And that's why Teman is called that, because Teman comes from the word Yamin, which means that it's found in the south. It's on the right side, which is the southern side. So therefore, based on that, and Tosfot takes up this position of Rashi and expands on it, this idea that either the Torah speaks about the world facing eastward, likely because the sun rises in the east, so we see that as being the front of the world, and the west being the back of the world, and therefore right and left would be south and north. Or, as Tosfot goes on to suggest, connecting it to the other case, is that the Shekhinah is b'maraf, that the Shekhinah is found on the western side, and therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who is found on the western side, faces towards the east, and therefore his Oref, allegorically in the west, and then his Yamin, his to the right, is in the south, and left is to the north. Those goes as far then to explain, what about the other opinions that think the Shekhinah is b'chol makom? What are they going to do with the fact that the directions seem to indicate that the front of the world is east, the back is to the west, and the Shekhinah is present in the Ma'arav? He says that that is just referencing to the Beit HaMikdash. Because in the Beit HaMikdash, where the Shekhinah was found on the western side, in that context, Shekhinah's present in the Mikdash is as if facing Klal Yisrael, who are davening the Mikdash towards it, is facing east because of its location within the western side of the Mikdash. So they don't see this as being koveya, the presence of the Shekhinah in the world, but simply a reference to the Mikdash, which is the central location in the world. And since in that location, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was found on the western side, therefore we, and facing out towards Bnei Israel, we refer to the world as Kedem, Achor, and Yamin and Smol. But not that that defines the presence of the Shekhinah everywhere, as opposed to over here, where Rabbi Abou thinks that this is defining where the presence of the Shekhinah is, which is on the western side. So now we're going to continue that pasuk in Kin Hazinu. Tizal katal imrati, and my word will flow like the dew. Zu ruach tzfonit, this is the northern wind, shemazelet et zahav, that causes the gold to be cheap. The way that Rashi explains mazelet et zahav, shemechamemet, because it's something that heats up the world and brings destruction and dryness to the world, and therefore there is drought and famine in the world, and things are extremely expensive, and therefore it depreciates the value of gold or money, because you have to pay so much of it to get the produce that doesn't exist. So that is this northern wind that is destructive. And we have a pasuk that supports it from Yeshayahu, Hazalim Zahav Mikis, that one who pours gold from the purse, but they're reading again the word zalim here from the word zol, to be cheap. So zalim zahav mikis, and Rashi notes the only proof in the pasuk is not contextually that it is proving the way that we're explaining it, but simply showing you that there's an association between the word zol and zahav, that sometimes gold is cheap despite the fact that it is a precious metal, and that's what we're proving from the pasuk in Yeshayahu. So just know that the Marsha over here learns just the opposite, which is that the cheapness of gold comes from the fact that there will be bountiful crops over here. That the wind that comes from the north, that brings the tal, that brings the dew, which usually we know from the Gemara Tanit, is associated with brocha and positive side to it. And therefore, given that, the crops will be bountiful and gold will be cheap. It means that everybody will have lots of money because there will be so much produce. Kisi irim ale deshe, like the stormy winds that come across the grassy areas. Zo ruach mizrachit, this is referring to the eastern wind, shemisaeret et kol olam kisair, because it stirs up the world, it brings a tempest to the world, like a sa'ir, and as Rashi notes over here, the sa'ir is a shade, is a demon that comes and stirs the pot or causes problems in the world. And therefore, that's why it has kisirim, the stormy winds that come like the sa'ir that cause problems. Ukarivivim alei esev, and like the gentle rains that cause the grass to grow. Zoruach dromit, that refers to the southern wind. Shimale rivivim umegadelet asavim, that brings the rains and causes the grasses to grow. Now, the Rabbeinu Gershom has a nice allegorical explanation over here to the Pasuk, and he explains that the way that the Gemara is reading, the way that Rashi read it, that the first statement of Yarov Kamatar Lichi is seen as being positive, as well as the last statement, which is Kerivim Alei Esev, whereas the two middle statements were seen to be more negative. And he then says the following, Yarov Kamatar Lichi, my teachings drip like the rain, Zeo Sik B'Torah Lishma, that is someone who learns Torah for the right reasons, Umarkino Znav Lishmoa Lichi, and he bends his ear to listen to my lessons, Ose Tova Leolam, he does something good for the world, Kimatar Zesh Ba Min HaMa'arav, like this rain that originates or comes out of the western side, which is the westerly winds that bring the moisture off the ocean and bring the rains with them. On the other hand, Tizal Katal Imrati, that will flow like the dew, my words, Hanu Shemizalzel Torah, this is a person who denigrates the Torah, Shosek Shelo Lishma, he does it not for the right intentions, Mevi Ra'ah Leolam, he brings difficulty or bad things to the world, Kurach Tzvoni, like the northern wind, Shemnashevu Mevi Ra'ah Leolam, which brings this difficulty or drought to the world. He goes on to explain the same thing with Kisirim Ale Deshe, that's Zeh Osek B'Torah Shelo Lishma, and Kerivim Ale Esev, Chosek B'Torah Lishma, Mevi Tuva Leolam, Kerivim Halalu Shiordim Benachat. So he sees the first statement and the last statement, which are positive, being associated with learning Torah Lishma, which results in goodness coming to the world, similar to the brachot of the rain that are mentioned here. Whereas when a person learns Torah Shelo Lishma, then they result in these difficulties that are mentioned in the middle two statements, because of the fact that they're bringing Ra'ah to the world. Now, before we go on to the next stage of the Gemara, we just have to understand something about the way that the world works and the perception that we have of how the world works. And that is, because we live in the northern hemisphere, that means that in general, the sun is found to our south, because we are north of the equator. The equator is the line on which the sun is usually found. When we revolve around the sun, as well as rotate around the sun, the equator is the location of the center of where the sun is vis-a-vis the earth. So if you're in the northern hemisphere, in general, the sun will be found to your south. If you're in the southern hemisphere, it'll be just the opposite. The sun will be to your north. That's number one. Number two is, because of the changes of the seasons between the winter and the summer, by which in the winter time we are much further north of the sun versus the summertime where we are much further south towards the sun. Again, I'm doing this from our perspective or the perception of how it looks, which is us in the northern hemisphere in the winter time. It feels like we are further away from the sun and the sun looks further south from us. On the other hand, in the summertime, but given the world's angle, we have a sensation of being closer to the sun. And that's because the sun moves basically between the two tropics, depending on the tilt of the earth, which is that you have the equator at the center and then you have the northern tropic and the southern tropic, the Tropic of Capricorn, the Tropic of Cancer, and the sun, based on the tilt of the earth, moves between those two tropics. We who live in the northern hemisphere are north of the tropics, so the sun will always be to our south. And similarly, someone who lives in the southern hemisphere who's below the tropic there, the sun will always be to their north. But that sensation of being towards the south has impact during the winter and the summer, where the sun is moving between the tropics. In the summertime in the northern hemisphere, where the sun is closer, is in the northern tropic, then the sun feels much closer to us, and therefore it's south of us, but not as far south. Whereas in the wintertime, where it's at the opposite tropic, it's at the southern tropic, the sun is much further south from us, or how we have the sensation of being much further south. That has the impact, if you look on the eastern horizon, the western horizon, when the sun rises or the sun sets, you will see, depending on whether it's the winter or the summertime, that the sun does not rise on the center of the eastern side, but rather it moves along the eastern horizon as to where it rises. And that in the winter time, the sun seems to rise on the eastern side much further towards the south. That is because the sun is further south relative to where we are. In the summertime, when the sun rises on the eastern horizon, it rises on towards the northern side of the eastern horizon, because in that case, we are much closer to the sun. The sun is further north at that period of time. At the two equinoxes, the sun will rise on the eastern side, directly in the center of the eastern side. And the same is true on the western side, that when the sun sets in the summertime, it will set towards the northern side of the western horizon. And in the wintertime, it will set towards the southern side of the western horizon. But given the fact that the sun is always south of us, therefore it has the perception of when you look at the sun during the wintertime, it rises on the eastern side, on the south side of the eastern horizon. It goes through the sky and seems to stay along the southern side of the sky, and then sets again on the southern end of the western horizon. So it looks like it's traversing the earth just on the southern side. Whereas in the summertime, the sun seems to rise on the northern side of the eastern horizon. Then because the sun's always in the south, it seems to traverse the whole eastern side, move to the southern side of the sky. And then when it's going to set again on the western horizon towards the northern end, it seems to move across the whole western side back to the northern end of the western horizon when it sets. So given the tilt of the earth and the vacillation of the sun from the perspective of someone on earth between the two tropics and being the northern hemisphere, all the observations that they made were correct. But now the Gemara is going to try to give a practical explanation to the phenomenon that they were observing. And that is Tanya, Rabbi Elazar Omer, Olam l'achsadra hu domeh. The world is like an achsadra. Over here, interesting enough, Rashi defines an achsadra as shein lo dofen revi'it, that it has three walls, and on the fourth side it is open. If you remember back on that daf, Yud Aleph Amud Bet, over there we had a machloki between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot as to what the definition of an achsadra is. Rashi thought an achsadra was a gazebo, something that was up on four poles and was open on all sides. Whereas the Balei Tosafot believed that an achsadra is closed on three sides and open on the fourth side. And over here you see Rashi actually giving the same explanation that the Balei Tosafot did back on Yud Aleph Amud Bet. But then, given that explanation, Veruach Tzvonit, the side that is open is the Eina Misovevet, is the part that is not open and where the sun doesn't go. V'kevin Shegia Chamait, so Keren Marvit Tzvonit, when the sun reaches the northwestern corner, Nichfefet Va'ole Lamalet, folds up and goes up above Minarakia, above the firmament. So basically, to explain this phenomenon, which is noting, as we saw before, that on the northern side, the sun doesn't spend any time. Therefore, Chazal assumed that the sun spent the overnight time period on the northern side. That is actually true today as well, but the Chazal had a geocentric view of explaining these phenomena, rather than, in reality, what is a heliocentric situation. And so we know that the sun goes beneath the earth in the overnight period, but the truth is that it's not going beneath the earth. It's simply that the earth is rotating on its axis and it looks or feels or simulates that idea that the sun is rising and setting or going below and above the earth. And then if you have a geocentric view, then you think that the sun is moving relative to the earth. And that's what he's explaining over here. How come the sun doesn't appear on the northern side? And that is because the world is like an achsadra. When we're talking about the world, we're talking about looking out into the sky. And what he's saying is that there's a solid barrier on the eastern, western, and southern sides of the sky. And that's what the sun travels through. It travels over those walls or those areas. And then the northern side, which is open, gives the sun the opportunity to exit from what this area, this hollow that is called the earth or the atmosphere, and then goes above the firmament and returns to rise again the next day. So it goes through that open end and then goes over the rakia to return the next day. And that's his explanation for this phenomenon. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Olam l'kubahu domeh. On the other hand, Rabbi Yeshua believes that the world is like a tent, a small building, meaning that it's sealed in on all four sides. Veruach tzvonit misovevet. And on the nighttime, it does move on the northern side. Kevin Shechama Magad the Karen Marvit Tzvonit. Once it reaches the sunset, it reaches the northwestern corner, Makefet Vechozeret Ochrea Kippah. It penetrates through the kippah, which is this solid covering, and then goes back over the top of the kippah to return to rise the next day. Now, even though neither of these explanations in reality turn out to be astronomically true, nevertheless, they do have implications both in terms of our davening as well as halacha. Just to give you an example is that we say in davening, ubokeya chalonei rakia. He penetrates or breaks through chalonei, the windows of the rakia. That is explaining a phenomenon. It's more explicit in the Gemara in Pesachim in the 9th Perek, which some of what I'm saying here is drawn from about the views of Chazal, that the sun would penetrate through the rakia, according to this view of Rabbi Yeshua, where there's no opening on the northern side. The way that the sun left the area where it was visible was that it penetrated through a chalon. There was a window in the rakia, in the kippah, that the sun went through, then went to the other side of the kippah and returned over the kippah overnight on the northern side. And it was dark because it was outside the kippah, which blocked the light from entering in. And then once again, it enters a chalon, a window, on the eastern side when it rises in the morning. And that's what we say in davening, ubokeya chalonei rakia. He penetrates or goes through the chalonei rakia, describing the movement of the sun. In addition, the shita, the famous shita of the Rabbeinu Tam of 72 minutes for Tzeitu Kochavim, which is premised on a number of factors, but his explanation revolves around a concept of the sun pushing through the kippah or the rakia when it sets. And that is that the sun goes away from being visible because it enters into that chalon. But while it's in that chalon, it still leaves the atmosphere lit, and that's why it's still light out. As it penetrates deeper and deeper through that chalon, there's less and less light in the atmosphere until it's finally on the other side of the chalon. And that's what Rabbeinu Tam describes as the different shkiyot. There's one shkiyah, or the first shkiyah is when the sun is no longer visible when it enters into the chalon. And then there's a second shkia when the light from the sun being in that chalon or in that tunnel going to the other side of the kippah finally goes away, because then that is the second shkia, or the moment where there's no more light within the atmosphere because it's already reached the other side of the kippah. So again, even though from a practical standpoint, these are not the scientific explanations for the phenomenon, nevertheless, they're explanations are giving articulation to phenomenon that they were observing, and their observations are correct. And so even though their final explanation of why it was happening is not correct, nevertheless, it does have ramifications or implications, because even in the scientific realm and the way that really happens, their observations are true and therefore have the implications of the Rabbeinu Tam, which is even though the Rabbeinu Tam's explanation for why there are two shkiyot is incorrect, it's still what he observed is true, which is that the sun does leave the horizon, yet the atmosphere remains lit. And that's because of the angle of the sun vis-a-vis the atmosphere, and that the atmosphere reflects the light from the sun. So even though the sun has gone below the horizon, the light from the sun still is residual in the sky, depending on the angle. And as the angle deepens, then less and less light is found in the atmosphere. So the phenomenon that he is describing exists, even though his actual practical explanation for it is not correct. Shenemar, because now he explains, Holeich el darom, v'soveiv el tzafon. And as Rashi notes over here, Holeich means hekeif hayom korei hiluch. When you're going, shu b'toch hachalal. That's with inside of the atmosphere, inside of the kippah. But hekeif halayla, where the sun goes at night, korei sivuv. It's called going around. Shu makif b'chutz, because it goes around the outside. And that's the explanation again before, which we described at the kippah, and the sun penetrating through the kippah and then going back over the top of the kippah. Holeich el darom bayom. It traverses or walks on the southern side during the day. That's for us in the northern hemisphere. The sun is always on the southern side of the sky. V'soveiv el tzafon. And it returns on the northern side overnight, because if it travels on the south, if it's making a circle, then at night it would be on the northern side to have it then rise on the opposite side when it came back in the morning. So soveiv, soveiv, around and around, holech haruach, the wind goes, v'atzfi botav, shavaruach, and from where it started, it returns this, elu pnei mizrach, upnei ma'arav. That is referring to the eastern sides and the western sides, shepe'amim misavavatam, upe'amim mehalachtatan. And this is a phenomenon, again, it's observable, the difference between the summer and the winter, which is that sometimes the sun travels the western side and travels the eastern side, but sometimes it does not travel through them, but rather returns over them. Because the explanation, again, would be that, say, for instance, in the summertime, where the sun rises on the northeastern corner of the sky, it has to then make it over to the southern side of the sky. How does it do that? It moves along the eastern horizon towards the south. So therefore, it's holich. It traverses the entire eastern horizon, rising on the northern corner and then moving towards the south, where it'll be at noontime, because the sun is always south of us because we're in the northern hemisphere. And then at nighttime, when it's going to set, it needs to make it back to the northwestern corner where it's going to set. Given that, it's got to now travel back along the western side or the western horizon until it reaches the northwestern point where the sun sets. That is true during the summertime. And therefore, at night, it only travels the northern side, is Soveiv on the northern side. On the other hand, in the wintertime, where the sun is much further away, when the sun rises in the morning, it rises on the southeastern corner. And therefore, when it wants to go to the southern side of the sky, it's already on the southern side. So it does not need to travel across the eastern side of the sky, but simply rises, goes through the southern side of the sky, and then sets again on the southwestern corner. In that case, where the Gemara says it's Soveiv, that the sun spends the time outside on the western and eastern side. That would also be the explanation for why the days are longer in the summer and the days are shorter in the winter. During the summertime, the sun spends more time within the halal, inside the atmosphere, traversing the entire eastern side, then the southern side, and then a whole western side. Those are the longer days. In the winter time, where it rises in the southeastern corner and sets in the southwestern corner, it only spends the day on the southern side, so therefore there's less light during the day. But then at night, it spends the time at night traversing the entire western side, then going around the north, and then a whole eastern side to return to the southeastern corner to rise in the morning. That makes the nights longer during the winter, but also calls them Soveiv. And that's what the Gemara is interpreting in the Pasuk, that depending on the time of the year, sometimes the sun is holeich, it traverses or travels the eastern and western sides, and sometimes it's Soveiv. During the winter time, it doesn't travel the western eastern sides during the day, but rather at night, so therefore it's on the outside, it's Soveiv, to return to the point where it's going to rise. And now, going back to Rabbi Eliezer's position, who says that the world is domed l'achsadra, then this pasuk is supportive of that view, which is min acheder tavo sufa, from the room comes the tempest, zu roach dromit, that is the southerly wind, umimizarim kara, and from the constellations comes cold, zu roach tzfonit, that is the northerly wind. Minishmat alitain kerach, from the breath there should be no ice. Zoroach maravit, that refers to the westerly wind. Ve rachav mayim bimitzak, and the expanse of solidified water. Zomruach mizrachit, that refers to the eastern side. So the reason that the cold or the constellations enter from the northern side is because the northern side is open, unlike the other three sides which are closed. And that's why they interpret the pasuk Mizarim Kara, that the cold of the constellations comes through the northern side, because according to Rabbi Eliezer, that's the side that is open. That's what Rashi explains, Shadofen Muzeret Uprutza, because that side is open. Whereas the Rabbeinu Gershom interprets Mizara as to be Zoreim, that it flows from that side, because again, it's open on that side. And then the Gemara says, Vaha Mamar Ruach Jomit Male Rivivin Umigadelet Asavim. So the Gemara brings a stira from before. Bama ruach. Didn't we say before in the Braita before that ruach dromit male revivim umegedelet asavim, that the southerly wind brings the rain clouds and it grows the crops? And over here you're suggesting that the rain comes from the eastern side, because it says rachav mayim bemutzak zuach ruach mizrachit. So how come in the Braita that we just brought, in Rabbi Eliezer's position, we say that the waters or the rains come from the east, whereas in the previous Braita, they came from the south? The answer to that question is, Lokasha hadach mitra benichuta habishvichuta. Depends on the type of rain or water that is coming. If it is coming from the southern side, that comes in a gentle manner. That's called revivim. If it comes from the eastern side, that's speaking about the solidified waters. That's talking about a tempest and big storms that come from the eastern side. That's the way Rashi explains the question and answer of the Gemara. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom over here says that the before in the bright you said kisirim alei desha zuruach mizrachit shemisaeret to kol olam, that causes storminess in the whole world. And yet over here it seems to be that when you're saying from the eastern side, it says rachav mayim bimutzak, that it becomes in the solidified or large blocks of water. So given that lokasha, that's not a problem. How the that the eastern side has two forms of bringing rain. There's rain that comes benichuta, which has been described in the bright over here. Habishvichuta, and then that which was described in the previous bright, which was negative, that is when it comes in a stormy and tempest form. So from the eastern side, you have two types of rains or water that emanate. Some of them are softer and nice rains, and other of them are more stormier tempest or greater tempest, which are negative rains that come from that side. On the other hand, the Marsha sees the steer between the explanation of the two southern sides. That over here it says that Minacheder Tavo Sufa, that it's a tempest or stormy weather comes from the south. And yet in the previous Braita we said with regards to the south that it was Kirivim Aleisev Zurach Dromit. So over there again you have a stira between whether the rains or the water coming from the southern side is gentle rain or is it a storm? And the answer again is Lokasha. Depends. It can come in both forms. Hashem brings the rain from that side, but it can come in a forceful, stormy form, or it can come in a gentle, more positive form. Amar Rav Chisda, my dichtiv, what is meant by the pasuk? Mitzafon zahav ye'eteh, that the golden sunshine will come out of the north. Zu ruach tzvonit shemazelet et zahav. This is the northerly wind which causes the gold to diminish in price. Chenu omer hazalim zahav mikis. It's the same thing that we had said in the previous Amud, that the northerly winds, which are difficult or dangerous and cause drought and famine, they cause gold to become cheap because people have to spend a ton of that precious metal in order to buy food. So it's as if the relative value of gold has gone down. He brings the same proof from the pasuk that we had in Yeshayahu. Avraham Rafram Bar Papa, Amar Rav Chisda, Miyom Shecharab Beit HaMikdash, Lohuk Shema Ruach Dromit. From the time that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, we never really get a full Ruach Dromit, Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, Vayigzor al yamin v'ra'ev, that he was gozer on the right, and as we described before, right refers to the south, and therefore famine came, Ve'uchal al smol v'lo saveyu, and they'll eat from the north, v'lo saveyu, and they will not be satisfied, Uchtiv, and they bring a proof Pasuk to that, Tzafon v'yamim ata v'ratam, north, and right, you created them. It's clear here that it's contrasting north and south. And so you see from here that Yamin refers to the south. And so Hashem is gozer on the Yamin, on the south. Therefore, there is famine, in that there's not as much brocha because we don't have that southerly wind. And that which is provided comes from the north or the northerly winds, and that will not satisfy them. And like we said in the Braita before, that the Ruach Dromit brought the Rivivim, brought the gentle rains that were good for the crops. That doesn't happen anymore. And this goes to a general approach of Chazal to the Churban HaBayit, which is that the Churban HaBayit was not just the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but was something that had cosmic implications in terms of its impact. Not only did it affect the fact that the Jews were put into exile and the Mikdash is destroyed and the Shekhinah leaves, but there are also other implications, including how the winds come and the brocha that is found in the foods. All of those were impacted by the Churban HaBayit. And that is borne out by the keynote that we say, especially on the night of Tisha B'Av, that there are greater implications to the Churban HaBayit than simply what seems to meet the eye. V'amar Avraham Bar Papa Amar Rav Chisda, Miyom Shecharab Beit HaMikdash, Ein HaGshamim Yordim Me'Otzar HaTov. That since the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the rain doesn't come from God's great storehouse. Shnemar, because the Pasuk says, Yiftach Lecha Hashem Lecha Totzaro HaTov, Hashem will open up His great storehouse, His treasures for you. Zman Shisrael Osim Ritzono Shel Makom. At the time that the Kodesh Baruch Hu was bidding, Yisrael Shruim Alad Matam, and the Jews live on their land, Gishamim Yordim Motzar HaTov. Then the rains come from the place of Bracha and the great storehouses of Kodesh Baruch Hu. Zman Sheisrael Shruim Alad Matam. On the other hand, when the Jews are not found on their land, and Gishamim Yordim Motzar HaTov, then the rains don't come from the great storehouse. Or in other essence, it dries out the land, or the land is not as productive and fertile as it was when the Jews were present. And obviously the Jews' presence on the land is connected to their doing the bidding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore he sees from that a connection between the success and fertility of the land and the fact that the Jews are found in the land of Israel. And that of course is borne out in the last century since the beginning of the Aliyah process and Jews returning to Eretz Yisrael, that the land has blossomed under with the return of the Jews or the presence of the Jews in the land. And that is the drasha of Chazal that Rashi brings in the Tochacha in Vayikra, that once you are thrown out of the land, it would be left desolate and destroyed. And he says that's a bracha because nobody else will be able to find consolation or make the place habitable until you return. and therefore it'll be left waiting for you to return to bring it back to life. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Harotze Sheyachkim Yadrim. Someone who wants to be wise, get smart, should go south. She Ashir, he wants to be wealthy, Yatzpin, he should go north. V'simaneich, and the way to remember that is Shulchan, the Shulchan in the Mikdash, which represents Osher and Parnosa, Bitzafon, sits on the northern side of the Kodesh. Umenorah, which represents light, Ner Mitzvah, V'Torah, or represents Chochmah and Torah. Badarom, sits on the southern side of the Kodesh. That's where you remember this. Person always go to the south. Because if you become wise and you gain knowledge, then you, by definition, or the outcome of that will be that you also become wealthy. That great long life comes from Yamin, from the right here referring to the south. In the learning of Torah and wisdom will bring one long life. Bismola, on the left side, on the northern side, Osher v'chavod, you have wealth and glory. Where the Rebbein Ochanan reads it is, Haikra lo ati l'shminen el de Torah shi chokhmah, the Torah that's chokhmah, yeshba osher v'chavod, also has osher v'chavod. Means that the Pasuk's not telling you, go to the south to get chokhmah, go to the north to get osher v'chavod, but rather that if you go to the right, you go to the south, or it means that you engage in Torah and wisdom and chokhmah, that will bring, by definition, also Osher v'chavod. Not to say that they are separate entities, but one precipitates the other. And that the putting your right hand, putting your priorities or your emphasis from the right hand on the chokhmah will result in the left hand, which is something that you have less emphasis on, but it will also appear, which is Osher v'chavod. That's both from a standpoint of what you invest your time in. You put your power, that which is on the right side, into chokhmah. And then you put little or less effort into the Osher v'chavod, which is represented by the left hand. But as the Rebbeinu Gershom says that, the proof text from the Pasuk is the fact that they're both associated with Torah, and that you don't have to do one or the other, but if you do Torah and Chokhmah, it will precipitate Osher v'chavod as well. It says, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi Amar Shechina b'marav. Then we just see in the previous Amud that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says that the Shechina is present in the western side. So then, if that's the case, what are you going to be doing, going to the north or the south, if you need to be going to west to face the Shekhinah? Demitzadeid atzdudei. That he moves himself or tilts himself a little bit in that direction. And that goes back to how Rashi explained before. What does it mean that you go north or you go south? It doesn't mean literally that you go north or literally that you go south, but rather it has to do with which way you face. When you face south, when you're davening, that is auspicious for the gaining of a chokhmah. Person who tilts towards the north, that's auspicious for Osher v'chavot. But since you're davening towards the western side based on Rabbi Shulman Levi, where the Shekhinah is, can't turn to the south or the north because then you wouldn't be facing the Shekhinah. So what we do is you tilt yourself or you orient yourself slightly towards the north or south. And the same would be true with regards to davening. If you're davening towards Eretz Yisrael or towards Yerushalayim, then the direction that you're facing, you can always tilt yourself in a certain direction. If you're in the east or the west, you can also tilt yourself north or south and gain the same effect of this auspicious nature. So I'm going to Rabbi Chanina, the Rav Ashi, or the other possibility is that the Rav Hushaya, going out to the Atvitu B'Tzvona of Eretz Yisrael, like us in Bavel, who live north of Eretz Yisrael, Adrimu Adrume, that we have to face south. And I think his question is, by definition, when we are up north, and then we're going to face to Eretz Yisrael, which is south, so then we, by definition, in davening south towards Eretz Yisrael, also gain this auspicious nature of Chokhmah. And that's why the Talmud Bavli, or in Bavel, has found this Chokhmah. Uminolan de Bavel etzvona de Eretz Yisrael kaima. How do you know that Bavel is north of Eretz Yisrael? Dichtiv, mitzafon tipatach hara'ah. Near Miyahu, he says that, mitzafon tipatach hara'ah koyeshvei aretz. And from the north will open up the front of all the evil and destruction that will come. And that's referring to Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel. And so the Pasuk says that he's coming from the north. Now the truth is that in all likelihood when he entered into the area of Eretz Yisrael, he came in from the northern side because that was the path by which someone who was coming from Bavel would come over into Eretz Yisrael because you have to cross through the mountain ranges. And generally the path that they took was coming from the north and then through the Golan Heights. And so therefore, yes, he will come from the north. Even though technically Bavel itself is really situated east of Eretz Yisrael, it's slightly northeast, but mostly east of Eretz Yisrael. Nevertheless, in their minds, they believe that Bavel was north of Eretz Yisrael. They have a similar phenomenon in the modern day as well, which is that the positioning of Poland is almost directly north of Eretz Yisrael. It's a little northwest of Eretz Yisrael. Yet the people in Poland, when they daven, they all daven eastward to face towards Eretz Yisrael. Even though in truth, they really need to face more south than eastward in terms of davening towards Eretz Yisrael. So people have a perspective or a concept of where something is located, either because of their orientation from either where they came from or how they entered into that area. Bavel, the way they entered Eretz Yisrael was from the north. Therefore, they orient in their minds, Eretz Yisrael was south of Bavel. And in Poland, they had come from areas to the west. And in the western areas, they were west of Eretz Yisrael, so they davened towards the east. And they continued to do so, despite the fact they had moved significantly east, and now we're more north of Eretz Yisrael than they were west of Eretz Yisrael. This goes back to what we learned in Daf Yud Chet, Amud Aleph. Tan Rabbi Yossi Matir B'Chardal, Sheyachol Lomar Lo. Rabbi Yossi allows Chardal because you can say to him, Ad Shato Omer Li Chachei Kardecha Min Dovarai, before you tell me to move my mustard away from your bees, Chachei Dvorcha Min Chardalai. Take your bees away from my mustard, Shebaot V'Achlot L'Glugei Chardalai. Because they come and ruin my mustard by eating. Rashi over here says, L'Glugei are Prachei Chardalai. Those are the flowers of the mustard. If you remember back on Daf Yud Chet Amud Bet, Tosfot over there quotes this Rashi, and then also quotes the Oruch, who said that it was the Garinim, the seeds of the mustard. And he says, Einir Alarit. The Re rejects both of them and says it refers to the Anafim, the branches of the mustard that they are eating, and that's what they were ruining. So whatever it is, Rabbi Yossi has this belief of bidirectional damage being done, versus the Chachamim who think there's only unidirectional damage being done, and that is of the damage the mustard does to the bees, but the bees don't damage the mustard. That helped us to explain the differences in their opinions in the sugya back on Daf Yud Chet. Now the next Mishnah begins. The Mishnah has been quoted numerous times through the Masechta so far, and so therefore we're familiar with it in pieces. And now we actually meet this Mishnah itself, which is Machikim et anilan min habor 25 ama. One has to, if they plant a tree, distance themselves a minimum of 25 amot away from a bor, a cistern in his friend's property, in order that the roots don't damage the cistern that's there. Ubucharuv shikma, when you're doing with carob and sycamore, 50 ama, you need 50 amot. Over here, Rashi notes, Shishora Shehem Mirubim. They have large roots or long roots. If you remember in the previous daf, we mentioned that the fact that they also have long branches or big branches, and you have to distance them from the city 50 amot for that reason. Ben Milomalo, Ben Minatzad. Whether it is above or whether it is on plateau with it, then you have to prevent the damage from happening. The Gemara will bring a brighter to explain where these locations are. Ima Bor Kedma, if the boar was there first, you cut down the tree, but you still have to compensate for the fact that you're cutting down the tree. Rashi gives the reason for that as, the kaven de b'shut nata, since you have permission to plant the tree, she'enu mazik atzman gadol. The damage is not immediate. The damage is not going to happen for a very long time. It may not happen at all. It depends on the growth of the roots and the time to elapse that the roots go far enough that the cistern is damaged by them, assuming that the cistern is still functioning, as well as the fact that the roots reach the cistern and damage them. Therefore, Rashi says, technically, you've done nothing wrong when you plant the tree. And basically, and Rashi reiterates this through the sugya, that if there is some sort of delay between the action that you take and the damage that is precipitated by it, in that case, you're really not responsible. Nevertheless, the Chachamim, for the betterment of society, said, don't leave the tree here because it eventually will do the damage. But in order to give you the right as his neighbor to take down the tree, you're going to have to compensate him for that. The Baalei HaTosafot, on the other hand, back on Daf Yud Chet, discussed this issue, and there they claim that the reason that you have to compensate for the tree over here is because it's a long-lasting asset. It's an asset with duration, and it's an expensive asset. Given that, we force you to compensate him to take out the tree, because in order to replace the tree, you're going to have to plant something. It's going to take a long time for it to grow back, and therefore we don't want you just taking down the tree without compensating him for that. On the other hand, the Ramban says the reason that we wanted you to compensate him is because the planting of trees is good for the yeshuv, and it helps to and helps us to inhabit the world and to live in a pleasant situation and good situations. Therefore, if you're going to take down a tree, we want you to compensate him because in some ways You're doing something destructive by hurting the yeshuv by taking down the tree. And the Ramban is really based on the Yerushalmi, who sees the entire machloket here about whether the yeshuv of the cistern is better than the yeshuv of the ilan, or the other way around. The yeshuv of the ilan is better than the yeshuv of the cistern. And so that is the machloket that we're going to see in a second between Rabbi Yossi and the Tanna Kamma, as to which one do we give precedence to. On the other hand, imilan kadam, if the tree was there first, lo yikotz, you cannot cut down the tree. Safek zekadam, safek zekadam. If it's a fake as to which one came first, lo yikotz. Again, we saw that in yesterday's daf, you don't cut it down. Because here the safek is whether you have a right to cut it down. Therefore, the bala bor who wants to take action has the burden of proof to show that it's necessary to cut it down. Yossi Omer, afa pisha tu bor kodemet ilan. Even though the bor was there before the tree, lo yikotz, you cannot cut the tree down. Each individual is utilizing their property in a manner that is befitting their property, and he doesn't have to worry about how he affects his friend. Now, that's not totally true, but he doesn't have to worry about the way he affects his friend because there's no giray delay. There's no immediate damage caused by what you're doing and how you're using your property, even though in the long run there will be damage that comes from what you do. But then the responsibility, as we saw back in Yudchet, according to Rabbi Yossi, lies with the Nizak. The Mazik can do this because he's not causing immediate damage. The one who's going to be damaged has to take the precaution so that it doesn't impact him in the future. And therefore, he sees the obligation in the Balabor to distance himself from the tree if he doesn't want the tree to affect him. Tana, Bencha Bor Lamata, Vilan Milamalo. We have a Braita that explains whether the cistern is below, Vilan Lamalo, and the tree is above. Bencha bor lamala, whether the cistern is above, vilan lamata, and the tree is lower. So we're talking about here the elevation of these items. So whether the cistern is on a lower elevation, the tree is on a higher elevation, or the other way around, whereby the cistern is on a higher elevation and the tree is on a lower elevation, in both those cases, it's problematic. The Braita, in essence, is giving explanation to the Mishnah, where the Mishnah says, ben milamala, ben milatzad, it's ambiguous as to what is the mala. And that's exactly what the Braita is saying. It's intentionally ambiguous because it doesn't matter whether the bor is the mala or the ilan is the mala. In both those instances, it is restricted. Mar says, Bishlamo bor the mata of ilan the mala. When the cistern is on a lower elevation and the tree is on a higher elevation, kazlin shorashin maskil al the bor. I understand why it would still be problematic because the roots go underground and the roots underground are going to damage the cistern. Elaborim ilamalo, if the bor is on a higher elevation, Vilan lamata, and the tree is on a lower elevation, amai, what's the problem? Even if the roots spread sideways, they're going to be below the level of the cistern, and it won't have a damaging impact. Because they weaken or soften the ground, and therefore they cause the base or the floor of the cistern to collapse. So even though the roots don't impact directly on the bor, they affect the integrity of the space underneath it. And as Rashi says over here, that they cause movement of settling of the area below because they penetrate the earth underneath the bor. And that will cause damage to the bor because of what they're doing from underneath. So now we continue with Rabbi Yossi's opinion. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Afu Pisha Bor Kodem Leilan No Yikotz, Shezechu Ver B'Toch Shalo, V'Zenoteya B'Toch Shalo. Am Rabbi Yudah Meshmol Alocha Ki Rabbi Yossi. We paskin like Rabbi Yossi, that it's ala nizak to distance himself in these situations. But Amar Rav Ashi, ki avan bei Rav Kahana, Rav Ashi says there is a qualification of this psak, because when we were in the Beit Midrash Rav Kahana, Avam Rinan, mo de Rav Yossi bi gire didei or gire delay. That Rav Yossi agrees when it's your arrows, when the damage can be directly associated with you, even Rav Yossi agrees that in that case it's ala mazik the charchika that's mo. And Rashi again, l'shitato, says that giri delay is heki dematele hezeka mitoch yadav shel mazik. It comes directly from the hands of the mazik. In addition, there is no delay between the action that he takes and the damage that is created. Or in essence, what he's describing here is what we described 2 days ago, back on Daf Chav Bet, as to what the difference is between garmi and grama. And then what the Rishonim are noting here seems to be many of the differentiations or notes that they made there. It has to be something that comes directly from you, the damage, in order to be considered giri delay. Or it has to be something that happens immediately without any delay, in order to be considered giri delay, which is the same thing that many of the Rishonim indicated was what made it into garmi rather than grama. And so giri delay, Rabbi Yossi over here says, is problematic. Pape Yonah, that's the name of this individual from this location. Ani, he was poor, v'he'eshir, and then he became wealthy. Havabana Padno, he was building a large mansion to live in. Havuhanuch Atsure Bishivute. There were these individuals who worked with sesame in his neighborhood. Tichavadaiki Shumshime, and they used to crush the sesame to get the liquid out of the sesame. Havanaida Apadne. His house used to shake from the banging of their hammers. Ata the Kamei Ravashi came before Ravashi and said, what can I do about this? Malei ki avan be Rav Kahana. He quotes him this memra that we had in the Beit Midrash of Rav Kahana. Arina and Modi Rabbi Yossi begiri delay. The Rabbi Yossi agrees when it's direct damage or direct cause and effect that over there, even Rabbi Yossi agrees that the mazik cannot continue to act in this way. Vikamo, how much can the impact of their hammering affect the house to the point where he can say it's giri delay and you guys have to move? The answer is, kinanayid nechtama apume dechatzva. If the cover of the barrel shakes every time they bang. As Rashi says, over here, if you put up a pitcher or barrel on the wall, bikisuya aleha, and its cover is on it, yanua kisui, the cover will shake or move every time they bang with their hammers. So that is the test to see whether the banging is sufficiently strong where he can say it's giray delay, it's actually being mazikim, it's actually impacting him. So a number of factors here. First of all, we see this idea that we pass like Rabbi Yossi with a qualification of Rashi, that Rabbi Yossi's din doesn't apply to giri delay. In that case, it's ala mazik lechachik atzmo. And here the mazik, those who are hammering, are causing direct damage. Their hammering is causing the shaking or the vibration to affect the house itself. Now, what's interesting about the case is that Baba Yonah lived there prior to building the house. And they were doing this beforehand. So in one sense, they created a chazoka to do what they were doing. So what the Gemara notes is that he was an ani. He was a poor person first. So when they were doing this originally, it was not relevant to him in terms of their banging because it didn't affect him. And therefore, their establishment of a chazaka is not a real chazaka because the reason he didn't demur in those cases is because it didn't affect him. But once it became impactful on him, even though he came after them, he still has a right to demand that they don't continue to do this action that causes nezek. And therefore, some Rishonim conclude from here that the only reason they don't get a chazaka for the nezek that they were doing is because it wasn't relevant before. But had he been in Ashir all along, and it was relevant before and he didn't object, they might be able to establish a chazaka as long as it's not those extreme types of nezek that we mentioned before earlier in the perek. Whereas others believe that there's never a chazaka for nezakim when they're at this magnitude. And therefore, even if you've been doing it for a while, if they finally, the person stands up and says, I can't take it anymore, this is a type of nezek that is at the level that matches with the Beit HaKisei and the Ashan. And over there, you can't establish a chazaka for nezek because the type or nature of the nezek is too great. Tosfot doesn't love Rashi's explanation for the test that is done here because he believes that if the banging was so strong to match up with the test that Rashi says, it would have been so significant that the walls would collapse from that type of banging. So there it says, "V'nir l'rid, dekad naida nechtamak shadam ochezakad biyado." So I'm at a case where he's holding the pitcher in his own hand. And it's really a parable, just like when a person walks with a pitcher in his hand, the cover shakes or moves. So too, if the walls of the house move a little bit, that is considered to be problematic. And so they're using this as a parable rather than a definition. But for him, the threshold of movement is much lower. Others explain similarly that you put the barrel down not on top of the wall, but next to the wall, and you see if the vibration causes the cover of the barrel to bounce around. Gemara continues and says, the Bay Bar Marion, Braid Ravin, the household of Bar Marion, the son of Ravin, Kiava Naftse Kitna, when they used to comb out the flax, Hava Azla Rakta Umazka Inche, the chaff or the discard used to go fly out of there and damage the people that were around them. After the Kamei de Ravina, they came to Ravina to complain about the damage that was being caused. And when we say that Rabbi Yossi obligates the mazik to distance himself and may be responsible, that's when it's direct from his action. That's when it comes out of his action or direct result of that which he is doing. Over here, their action isn't doing it. It's the wind that is picking up the chaff and then moving it to the other location. So it's the wind that is the contributing factor, and that's not considered to be giri delay. So Matkivlo Amar Bar Ravashi. So the son of Ravashi says, is that really true? Maishna Mizore Veruach Misayato. How is that different than the Malacha on Shabbat, where a person is winnowing and the wind helps him to do the winnowing. Over there, we still consider it to be a malacha, even though the wind is urav, is mixed in here. And why don't you say the same thing by the combing of the flax? Yes, the wind is involved in the process, but still there are two parties to the process. There's you and the wind. And you are a contributing factor to which the wind adds something, and you should be held responsible. So Amruah Kamei de Meimar. So they said this over, this question in front of a Meimar. Amalu, Hainu Zore, Veruach Misayato. And Meimar corroborated this question of Mar Rav Ashi and said that just like by Shabbat, it has a din that the Ruach is considered to be his Koach. So to over here, by Nezek, it should also have a consideration to be considered his Koach. Uravina, Maishnami Gates, Ayotsemi Tachar Padish. How is this different for Ravina when you have a spark that comes out from the hammer when you're banging a hammer on metal? The blacksmith is banging the metal and all of a sudden a spark goes out. Fezik, and it does damage. The Chayev the Shalem is responsible for the damage. Even though, again, there it's the wind that carried the spark. Hatam Nechale Delezo. Over there, he wants the spark to fly out because the spark flying out takes it out of his house or out of the area where it can do damage to him. And therefore, he's favorably inclined towards that. Hachalo Nechale Delezo. Over here, he doesn't care if the stuff flies away with the wind. He simply wants the chaff or the discard to move away from that which he's combing, but he doesn't need it to go flying anywhere. That's not his vested interest, and therefore the wind doesn't act, quote-unquote, on his behalf. And that's the reason given to as to why Ravina thinks that the case by Gates is different than the case over here. But the Gemara doesn't explain is how is Ravina's din different with regards to Nezek vis-a-vis Shabbat. Meimar and Mar Rav Ashi thought the din should be the same for Shabbat and Nezek. Yet, Ravina doesn't believe that, and he says that they were not chayav over here, despite the fact that it is considered a malach on Shabbat. So for that, you need to go to the Gemara and Baba Kama. And the Gemara and Baba Kama speaks about what's called Melechet Machshevet. Melechet Machshevet is the requirement that on Shabbat, when you do malacha, your intent and the outcome that you desire is important than malacha. Generally, Melechet Machshevet is a kula in Shabbat. It turns out that if something happened unintentionally on Shabbat, you're not chayav. If the outcome that you desire didn't happen, then it's also not chayav in Shabbat because you need melechet machshevet. You need intent and you need the melacha to do exactly what you intended it to do. If you're lacking in either of those, then you're not chayav in Shabbat. So generally, melechet machshevet is a requirement of a melacha of Shabbat that is turns out to be a kula. Rare occasions where melechet machshevet turns out to be a chumrah, and this the Gemara Baba Kama brings as one of those exceptions to the rule. And that is that when it is a person doing a malacha, zoreva ruach misayato, over there, the malachet machshevet, his intent is to throw the stuff up to winnow and have the wind carry it away. So in terms of malachet machshevet, it accomplished, the wind helped him to accomplish what he wanted. And therefore, you do have malachet machshevet over here. Whereas with regards to nizakin, the qualification to be chayav and nezek is whether it's direct damage or grama or causal damage. And over here, the wind makes it into causal damage instead of direct damage, and you are patur. So it'll turn out here that Melechet Machshevet will turn out to be a chumrah, by which now you'll be chayav in Shabbat for the melacha, because you accomplished what you wanted, even though the wind was helping you out, and it wasn't all your koach, but that's what you wanted. And therefore, you're chayav by nezakin, you'll be patur, because of the fact that it's grama, and not a direct koach of yours. And that is the answer that Rashi quotes, to explain this position of Ravina as to why he differentiates between Nizakim and Shabbat. Whereas Mar Rav Ashi and Mar Meimar are going to say that we're going to extrapolate. If it has a din of being your koach by Shabbat, then we're going to assume by Nizakim it also has the same din as being your koach. Therefore, we're going to hold you responsible for it by Nizakim, even though if you looked at it in an isolated manner, it would be a din in Grammel. The Bali Dozvot asks, why over here do we say that this isn't similar to the Nezik of Eish that we saw in Baba Kama? But we know that if a wind blows Avno Sakino Masa'o off the roof, that you're held responsible for that if it damages in a Ruach Mutsuya, if it damages in a normal wind. So he says, Vomeri, Delo Domi Le'esh. This situation is not similar to Esh. Dein Chayav Mishum Esh El Kisha Asad Dam Et Esh. You're only Chayav Ba'esh where you are the cause of the problem that's there. V'hocha Eino Sele V'do Kol Ikar El Yedei Ruach. Over here he doesn't do anything, but rather the wind is doing it. Because if it were not for the wind, this stuff wouldn't move at all. It's equivalent of you bellowing a fire while the wind is also blowing on the fire and causing it to spread where you are, patur. Or in essence, by the case of your stuff on the roof, you put the items in a position where when they fall off the roof, they're going to cause damage, and the main damage is caused by the item itself taking flight. Only that the wind does is causes the item to take flight, the damage is done by the item itself. On the other hand, when it comes to here by the waste that is being blown away by the wind, the ikar damage is being done by the wind. It's not the waste itself that's causing the damage, and it's not the weight or the heft of those items. It's simply the fact that the ruach took it from here to there. And therefore, the primary contributing factor to the damage is not you, but rather the wind. And that's how the Baalei Tosafot differentiate between those cases of Eish versus the case over here where we don't say you are a chayav. And then Tosafot goes on to say that the machlok here is not about whether you have to compensate for the nezek, but rather whether you have to be marchik yourself. Do you have to take yourself away and stop or desist from this activity? Tosafot asks, why isn't this similar to the case of Gorin that we saw in the Mishnah yesterday, where you have a granary, a threshing floor that causes damage, and we demand that you put it 50 amot away so it doesn't cause damage? So he says the difference is that the Mishnah over there was according to the Rabbonon, and over here, this is according to Rabbi Yossi. And therefore, they have different thresholds for what is considered to be problematic and when you need to distance yourself. And that's why over here, there's no requirement to distance yourself. You're, of course, not chayav for the nezek, but the obligation to distance yourself also doesn't exist because according to Rabbi Yossi, this is not considered to be girei delay. There are other Rishonim who disagree and say that the machloket is more fundamental here as to whether when you do damage with this, are you chayav or not? And that's the machloket between Mar Baravashi and Ravina. Okay, we're going to end here by the Mishnah on the top of Chavov Amud Aleph.